according to your Twitter bio, your X bio now, your Zitter bio, that you're like a cognitive anthropologist and social psychology. That intersection is your thing, yeah?
Yeah, I think that is correct, because my degree was in anthropology, particularly my PhD was in anthropology in the Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology Center. And then after that, I did fieldwork and was based in a social psychology lab, and I now teach psychology in the psychology department. So I think I can lay claim to having at least a toe in both disciplines.
Would you call yourself a scientist of a sort, or are you an empirical
social
minded
scientist.
Psychologist?
A social scientist.
Social scientist.
So
I understand.
Yeah. I think the qualifier is important, but I'd say that I do aspire to make things more like rigorous and science-like, but accepting that social phenomena don't work exactly as well as, you know, photons and electrons.
Yeah, so it's not lab conditions you're studying, yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, we have run, like, I have run studies in, you know, theoretical, like relative lab conditions, but not they're not controlled like the Large Hadron Collider. So that's the I think the distinction is worth noting.
Yeah. So let's chat about the gurus then. You're decoding the gurus podcast. I recommend everybody listens to it. It's great fun. And my first question is, yeah, because you are kind of doing research on this, aren't you? There's going to be our research will come out of this eventually. And that's one of the things that's interesting to me about it. Actually, it's research in the making, decoding the gurus. I kind of see you draw your conclusions as you go along. My question is, do you start seeing gurus everywhere now? Now that you're studying it, like, is it like online influencers, tech bros in Silicon Valley, or like crypto profits or something like that?
Yeah. So the answer is yes, definitely. I think, you know, in general, my other research interest was rituals and ritual psychology. And after you start paying attention to rituals, you start noticing they're everywhere, right? And, you know, it just depends on how broadly you extend the definition to how much a lot of things fall under that category. And gurus works in the same way. We tried to, like, carve out a little bit of a specific niche with, you know, the secular qualifier.
Right,
and
we'll talk about that, yeah.
Even with that, I think it is certainly the case that there's a whole bunch of related phenomenon and historical phenomenon that are, you know, orbiting around similar dynamics. And I think there's interesting distinctions to make between, like, prophets and shamans and, you know, alternative healers and gurus and all these kind of things. But in some respect, you know, you are drawing artificial categories with fuzzy boundaries. So there's definitely overlap, but it's definitely the case that, like, after paying more attention to the people and the sort of characteristics that they display, that it does make you more aware when you see them cropping up in, you know, different content or different contexts. And even one thing that we've done, which is I think makes us feel a little bit better about it, is we did try to say, okay, the people we're covering are different in various ways, and some of them display some of the characteristics more than others. So we have a kind of family resemblance style definition, and it could be that there are, you know, exemplars that are really dinging all the characteristics and they're very much in line with the archetype. And then there are other people who are only exhibiting some of the characteristics, and then in those cases, you know, maybe they don't fit so well into the archetype, but there's some component of it that they're lighting up. So I don't think it is correct to say, though, that, like, everyone is a little bit of a guru or something like that. Like, I think this is an extreme of this distribution. So everybody might have some of the tendencies, but if you have a lot of them at a high degree, you're an unusual, unusual human.
The philosophers would say, yeah, you meet all the necessary and sufficient conditions of being a guru, which we are actually going to go through. But just to give people a kind of an idea of the people you deal with on the podcast. So, like, well, you deal with tons. And as you say, you have the gurometer, which is kind of a tongue-in-cheek way of a tongue-in-cheek taxonomy, I guess, of traits. And, you know, so some of the figures you deal with or have dealt with, you've sort of like Jordan Peterson, Joe Rogan, Lex Friedman, the Weinstein brothers, Brett and Eric, I think, Russell Brand, But also you deal with, like, let's say, non-right wing folk like Sam Harris. Although I don't, maybe
for example,
maybe some Muslims might disabuse me of that. Chomsky, for example, Rutger Bregman, Ibram Kendi, Gwyneth Paltrow, Robert DiAngelo, and so on. And you score them effectively, and some are more intense on the scale than others, which is cool. But like, what I'm interested in then was all these folks. I'm wondering, is it a new version? Like, what is this secular gurus like? Is it a new version of an old vintage?
Yeah.
Are we dealing with something historically new at the moment?
Yeah, this is like a question that Matt and I have been interested in, and I've been recently just presenting some talks and trying to like think it through. And I think the answer that I'm comfortable with at the minute is that it is a modern incarnation of a fairly long-standing and cross-culturally recurrent role in human societies. But that doesn't mean that there aren't distinctive characteristics. Like, the reason that we put the secular qualifier at it is specifically because we want to draw the distinction that our gurus are mostly relying on sources of authority that don't come from religion and spiritualism and like secret knowledge, right? It's more that they are masters of psychology, technology, history, science, a whole evolution, a whole like kind of supposedly scientific and secular sources of knowledge. And there are various characteristics, I think, that relate to contemporary ecosystems. For example,
technologically driven?
Yeah. I mean, things just like the ability for long-form podcasting to exist and for people to develop parasocial relationships that are not the same way they consumed content from, you know, the media 15 or 20 years ago, even. And then on top of that, the ease of which it is that people can build audiences and draw like massive followings, get huge media attention. I think all of that, you know, results in quite different dynamic, because previously there were a whole bunch of people that were occupying this role. Some of them were famous, some of them were not. But to become like a, you know, a disciple of a guru in the past, I think actually was a bit more of a hassle. Like, you know, it wasn't as easy as just clicking on Twitter or X and hitting follow or watching their YouTube channel. So
yeah, you had to meet people. Yeah
And it, you know, that had good and bad points in terms of what happened to the people that
just a tad.
Yeah, but I wouldn't make the claim that it's something that has sprung out of the ether, you know, with no connection to preceding traditions. But I do think there are some distinctive things. And I think like Jordan Peterson in a different era might have been demagogue preacher in some church or whatever. But in our era, he's a secular guru that builds a following.
With a massive YouTube channel, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was trying to think, like, what are the conditions, or what are the traits of the traditional gurus? The newer iteration of it, the new vintage, seems to be, I don't know, are they less violent? You know, the charismatic leader, behavioral control, intimidation, separating from families, all those traits that you get in cults. Is that something that you see manifest?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of occasions where there has actually been developed like kind of classical, you know, high demand cults where people need to go somewhere, need to devote their time and savings to a particular teacher or community. And those are still ongoing. Like, there's new ones cropping up even within the kind of communities that we're covering, but maybe more towards like the conspirituality and, you know, highly conspiratorial communities. But that kind of high demand group, where you have a charismatic leader and you have a physical location that people go to, I do think that is a difference. And it's a better difference in a way that, like, the fact that the connections that people form are often less substantial, or at least require less, you know, monetary and physical commitment. But it's kind of made up for that by the relative plethora, you know, potential guru figures that people now encounter, whether they want to or not. It would be quite hard, I think, for somebody to be online on a whole bunch of platforms over the past 5 years and not have heard about Andrew Tate,
right?
For example, and a lot of what the people are doing in their communities, particularly when you get past paywalls and stuff like that, when you, you know, are more that you actually are not just reading something online, but you've actually made some sort of like basic level of commitment, there you do see a lot of the same toxic manipulations and emotional manipulations that you would have associated with exploitative cults before. But it still is often that the people can leave in a much easier way. So, you know, that I do generally think it's a positive, but kind of counterbalanced by the ease of access.
That's one of the distinguishing features of cults, I think, you know, that you can't leave or they will do their damnedest to stop you. In some sense, you can unsubscribe from Jordan Peterson's YouTube channel should you desire it.
I think one of the things is the extent to which you become involved in communities, because, you know, this is not exactly related to the kind of secular gurus that we cover, but, you know, QAnon communities and various other online communities can create genuine communities, right? Like, a lot of people have online relationships that are very important and, you know, they've like formed lifelong friendships, right? Because that's the age that we live in. And I don't think there's any issue with that. I think you can have like completely genuine online communities, but it also means that people can end up like highly reliant on the new connections that they've formed. And there's various horror stories where, you know, people end up abandoning families for conspiracy communities. And in those cases, it is, again, like you said, that the when there's a demand to kind of alter your normal life for your right. commitment to this new group and new approach, right, in a way that damages your previous connections and potentially isolates you from friends, family, or people that think differently, that's like, it should be like a big huge red, you know, warning sign going off, but it isn't always. And there was a figure called Stefan Molyneux, you may or not be familiar with him, he was kind of popular about 10 years ago, a Canadian, I think he originally was Irish, but in any case, he was based in Canada, and he styled himself as the number one largest philosophical channel on the internet. His community was called Free Domain Radio, and he was initially a kind of anarcho-capitalist or anarcho-libertarian. I can't remember. He went through so many different ideologies, but the reason I mention him is like he's now ended up like far right ethno-nationalist, but he also mostly appealed to like secular right. stuff. Anti-spanking was a big part of his community, but he very much, he had this whole concept called defoo, which was like removing yourself from your family of origin because they are, you know, abusive and don't accept your anarcho-capitalist,
which is classic cultic behavior, right, isn't it?
Yes. And he had lots of teenagers come and stay in a house near him and stuff. So like but it was all initially online, and he was documented in a couple of British documentaries, you know, highlighting new kinds of online cults emerging. But he reinvented as like a partisan MAGA Trump pundit. He's still around, but he's kind of, you know, faded into the background. But I suspect that he's faded into the background and now has a, you know, a devoted community with enough money that he doesn't get that much mainstream attention, but maybe he doesn't need it anymore.
So following on from that, the question then is the secularism of it. So in some sense, yeah, so if we understand secularism to be a diminishment of the role of religion in the public sphere, say, sort of a classic definition of it, and we're joking about Nietzsche before we started, like, but, you know, are these a response to that, in some sense, the absence of religion in the secular world, that all of a sudden we engender this multiplicity of beliefs systems? So rather than having a belief in God or the mystic or the way or the secret or the force or whatever, now it's just sort of diffused across society and culture. And then you throw algorithms at the internet and social media to the mix, and it's amplified even further.
Yeah, it is interesting because there's a kind of contradictory dynamic. Like, on the one hand, there's the fact that I think it was it's changing a little bit, but I'll still make the case that it was like a little passé to be appealing to, you know, divine revelation and, you know, referencing the Bible just in terms of like, you know, Corinthians whatever says yeah. that you shouldn't do this. Like, but it, on the other hand, it's perfectly fine. And in fact, it's very attractive to interpret the Bible as a evolutionary store of knowledge or as a psychological guide of how to ascend status hierarchies or something like that, or to present religious insights as tapping into like a more fundamental metaphorical image-based symbolic layer of existence. So the literal truths, you know, you can kind of dance around what your particular position on that is, but the important thing is you're approaching religious material in a kind of modern manner, right? Like a reinterpretive exercise. So I think that there was initially an attempt to present it as a science rationality, a bit like, you know, the kind of new atheist like legacy.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I was thinking a lot of these are hardcore rationalists, which is, I thought, was a distinguishing feature. Even someone like Jordan Peterson, who's like, who, well, I mean, his self-description of himself is as a kind of a very empirical-minded psychologist.
Yeah, that's, unfortunately, it's, yeah, that's what Jordan Peterson says. I don't think that's true at all. Like, I think he's much better understood as a psychoanalyst, you know, a Jungian psychoanalyst, but yeah. The thing which makes me like hesitate a little bit is that applies to, you know, figures like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson in a way, Eric and Brett Weinstein, and you could also Rutger Bregman or Jonathan Haidt or, you know, any, like, I think they start to lean more just into public intellectual roles. But in any case, that does apply. But you also have now a plethora of people who are like crossing over from the conspirituality and mystical inclined realms into the conspiratorial, like, secular guru one. So, you know, Russell Brand
springs to mind.
Yeah, Joe Rogan as well. Like, you know, Joe Rogan might not initially seem to embody that, but Joe Rogan has always been someone interested in, like, mysticism, alternative history, UFOs, the occult, right? Like, that's what he, like, really gets him going. So you have that kind of dual thing where, and actually something which has just happened recently, which is, you know, banging around my head, is a whole number of the people who were presenting themselves as more secular and science-based, a figure like Andrew Huberman, for example, have come out and kind of emphasized that they've found faith and prayer and they're getting insights from religion. And on the one hand, it's perfectly normal for scientists to be religious. That not as common as like the normal general population, but it's certainly there's plenty of religious scientists. But on the other hand, the fact that there's so many of these figures who have seemingly discovered suddenly the value, and it's typically traditional Christianity that they have discovered, you know, the important value at the same time that they're starting to lean towards conservative politics. So I'm not saying it's not sincere, but I'm just saying I suspect they are picking up on a, you know, two-way interaction with audience demands and their networks.
Yeah, now that you say it, those who would be more into the sort of esoteria and mysticism and secret knowledge, they too were might be quite open to quantum woo.
If you've listened to the podcast, you're probably aware of this, but I think most normal people are not, but there's a kind of community of intellectuals. Jordan Peterson would probably be the king of that whole arena, but it broadly falls under the term of sense makers or game B thinkers, and you could describe them as amateur wannabe philosophers or theologians. They're kind of like in between somewhere there, and
yeah,
so those people tend to be very open to alternative ways of knowing, religion having, you know, mystical knowledge, science being, you know, limited in what it can do, introspective practices being just as important as, you know, empirical insight. So they often are referencing, you know, traditional religion. The thing that they want to emphasize is it's not in the normal standard way that people, you know, like that my parents, for example, are Catholics, right? No, that's too passé, so to speak. Same with Jordan Peterson.
Too normie, yeah.
Right? Like that my family are all Irish Catholics and none of them talk about religion one-tenth of as much as the supposedly secular figures in the guru sphere. So, yeah.
That chimes with my experience as well, Chris. Yeah, so if I just think of my dad, this is like, oh, like, you know, it's either Pishogues or religion, basically. He says, like, you know, this. So I'm sorry, I'll have to explain what Pishogues are, which are like, to non-Irish folk, it's like fairy stories and supernatural ritual practices and things like that. Yeah, so that's his, like, that's the alternative you have, like, and then you shut up about it.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing for me is I do think that a lot of them would be bored stupid at the actual, you know, like bog standard Christianity, going to mass once a week, where you are not the person orating about the, you know, the correct way to interpret the Bible. That's just received the, you know, the homily or the reading. So their approach is much more
Protestant
in a way. It's probably a Protestant, like an engagement with the text and a personal relationship. So
so there's like there's no mediation between yourself and your God. There's no institutional or experts or anything. It's a direct relation. Like you don't need a preacher. I'm the preacher.
Yeah. And they hold court in the way that preachers are in that archetype. Or, you know, Jordan Peterson directly compares himself to a prophet. Like it's not other people saying that. He in an interview was saying, you know, am I a prophet? I guess, you know, I kind of am in various ways. So like, this is one thing that constantly comes up in the content that we look at, that we are, you know, talking about people being narcissistic, about being conspiratorially prone and whatever, but they often just declare it. It's like outright, like you don't actually need much subtext, because they say, I am the person that has understood something which nobody else has. And, you know, I could save the world if people would put me and my friends in power. And you're like, this feels very on the nose.
I know this is only anecdotal, but recently Russell Brand said that, didn't he? He was like going, I've been thinking a lot about God and there's lots of voices in my head. And I was thinking, what if one of them was God?
Yeah.
I was like going, oh dear. You're just basically saying you're God? That's not much of a step there, like, you know.
that was quite impressive. And similarly, Brett Weinstein, the American ex-academic, but in the monologue, he compared himself to the character in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the young woman who worked out how everything worked. And he said, you know, in a way, I kind of think I'm like that woman. And just like, even if you thought that, would you say that out loud with a camera? But I've been saying recently that the one thing which almost all of the secular gurus have, which is something of a superpower in the modern online ecosystem, is they're immune to feelings of shame or self-doubt, right? The way that you might put it, if you were like a Zoomer or a millennial, is they are immune to cringe. They don't care. If, you know, like, it's not even that they don't care. I think it's just that they don't react the same way to it. Because like Brett Weinstein, again, just staying with him because he fits the archetype very well. He has been on various podcasts complaining at length that Elon Musk blocked him after he sent him like a litany of DMs.
Yeah, I've seen this actually.
Right. And you would feel at some point, you know, self-awareness, where you're talking about being blocked for being so annoying, and you're casting it as this grand conspiracy that you don't know what happened and it doesn't make any sense and all this thing. And you can see thousands of comments like, it's because you're annoying, it's because you're like, stop doing this. But he doesn't you know, absolutely untheist. He will bring it up in the next interview.
When gurus collide, yeah. I would have probably put like Elon Musk on your barometer.
Oh, yeah, we did cover him. He scored quite highly.
Okay. Well, let's just so like listeners can figure it out. I have the list here of, I suppose, what philosophers call the essential and sufficient conditions. And if you're demonstrating all of these traits, you might demonstrate some of them.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, you're scoring high on the barometer. Yeah. So I'm just going to list them out and maybe I'll talk to you to about two or three of them.
Yeah.
So you say galaxy brainness, cultishness, anti-establishment theorism, grievance mongering, Cassandra complex, so a kind of claim to soothsaying or superior prescience, I suppose, revolutionary innovative theories, yeah. My favorite, pseudo-profound bullshit, so the semblance of profundity. I am a philosopher, Chris. Conspiracy mongering, I'm sensitive to that one, profiteering, grifting, I guess, and since making one as well, or is that a new edition or something you're working out?
Oh no, it's just a particular genre of secular guru is the way I would put it. It's if somebody is prone to sense making, they are probably a secular guru, but it is not one of the characteristics because it's like kind of a subgenre.
No, because in philosophy, it's a term that those of us from the phenomenological tradition would be comfortable enough with. I don't think that's what actually you mean. So like, you know, kind of embodied cognition and that domain of philosophy of mind.
Yeah, no, it isn't. Although they do talk about that. And we recently spoke with the neuroscientist, Kevin Mitchell, who has a book about like free will.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, I listened to that one. That was great.
And he talked quite a lot about sense making, because it is a useful word and it does mean stuff, and you know it is used in different disciplines too. And he was you know using it in the sense of like biological entities trying to interpret signals from the world in a way that serves their persistence goals,
the evolutionary needs.
Yeah. So, but that's not what the sense makers tend to use. But they can reference that kind of thing as well. So we are using it in a bit of a disparaging way, because the other thing.
Yeah. So there's more order out of chaos, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's how can I help all these followers navigate chaos with this sort of, I don't know, this sort of Baroque.
Exactly.
Since making
exactly.
Map.
I think it does work with the pseudo-profound bullshit in a way, because it's essentially whatever you could say in, you know, 1 minute, why not use 15 minutes and as many extended, elaborate metaphors and references to esteemed thinkers in history? Like, surely that's better than the 1 minute version. That's the kind of sense maker approach, is nothing that can be said simply is that worth saying. Better to say it in the most complex way possible, even if it's a very mundane point.
Yeah, I think some of my discipline might be responsible for some of that.
I mean, you know, there is a thing that it is true that this is a characteristic that academics are guilty of. I think in every discipline, the psychology and stuff as well, academics just in general are prone to this. But it's ideally you would want it to not be the primary thing that you're doing, right? You would want it to be when things have gone wrong, as opposed to this is the fundamental characteristic of your field. So it might be true for some academic fields, but I'll not throw sheets at them.
I was wondering then, could I, just to move on, like I could talk about the sort of some of the features like galaxy brainness. Could you explain that a little bit, Chris? So is it just a confidence trick in some way? You know, that kind of, is it a rhetorical technique where you adopt the sense-making aura and you make yourself appear deeper than you actually are?
Yeah, well, in some sense it is, but it's also, like, I think it's a genuine skill, because I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, the Gish Gallop technique, right? Or filibustering in general, as like a, you know, just yeah. in a kind of debate setting, that tends to be throw out as many things as possible, and the other person responding will be like, kind of, it's difficult to rebut everything, right, if you've thrown out a ton of stuff. So I think it's related to that, but what is a bit different in the way that we are talking about it is it's really aping the polymathic ability of people that are considered geniuses or great thinkers. So like, one of the things about polymaths is the fact that they've right. mastered, you know, so many disciplines and they see connections that other people can't. And the secular gurus want to demonstrate that they have that ability. So they'll want to reference things from different disciplines, from, you know, world literature, from history, from psychology, from science, to kind of, but in a performative way, not in the way that you would do, you know, if you were trying to make a point and yes, you wanted to reference
Leonardo da Vinci would or Oppenheimer.
Yeah, yeah. But those are too mainstream. That's too mainstream. That's the your problem is, you know, you've got to be more hipsterish.
So it has to be a bit edgy, a bit...
Yeah, like Derrida and Foucault...
Yeah, so it has to be alternative.
...are okay, but, you know, a bit too normy. People will have heard of that. Better to, you know, read...
Oh, they are now, yeah. They're the orthodoxy now, yeah.
Yeah. The only other thing I'd say about it is, like, it kind of what you said, that, you know, it is the presentation... of deepness and mastery of a whole range of topics and an ability to loquaciously hold forth right on topics and link them all together. So I think you could put it as like claimed polymathic ability, because when somebody actually has polymathic ability, they're known as like a polymath, right? Like people will introduce this is he's a noted polymath. But if you are the one that's constantly trying to tell people that you're a polymath, that's like, again, a little bit cringy, might be the way to put it.
But that's not a problem, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That is interesting. So I kind of look at that as a kind of a version of sort of inflating an ego, isn't it, as well? Like that, which you get in cult leaders, obviously. It's all about the traditional cult leaders is about like the connection between the ego of the leader and some kind of secret knowledge that only they have access to, like, I don't know, like Manson or Osho or someone like that.
There was a guru that we covered called Jordan Hall, who was actually the CEO of DivX, the old like codec. I think, you know, he was there
right
whenever the tech boom happened and got a very substantial payout. But he's somebody in the sense-making sphere, and he described himself as running 70 to 90 distinct paradigms simultaneously. And whereas normal people are at best running one or two, right? So we are trapped in our single paradigms, but he's spinning all of them around. Although, ironically, he has now very recently converted to Christianity. So I guess he has also collapsed down to a single master paradigm.
He says, well, he's got one paradigm now. That's handy.
Yeah.
So the other one then is, well, we talked a little bit about cultishness, but one of the things I'm wondering, could you shed some light on for me is in your analysis of these and sort of the research you're doing on it, in terms of selection, and I think you've done some of research of this in another context, but in terms of group cohesion, in grouping and out grouping is what I'm talking about. Do you notice that there's policing effects? There's a policing of, say, problematic members of the group.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that is, we described it as like cultishness or encouraging cultish dynamics. And we are not saying, you know, that you need to book a hall and like get everyone to dress the same color and like show up every week or... But it is a lot of the same psychological features. And one of the clearest ones is the casting of people of the in-group as the good, just, thoughtful, you know, people that are willing to think deeply about things, whereas the people outside are the ones that are unawakened sheeple who are just, you know, receiving whatever the institutions are feeding them with. And they are potentially malevolent, or at least they're duped by malevolent forces. So you have like a very strong in-group out-group creation, and then like you hinted at, you also have these dynamics where they're quite exploitative parasocial techniques. So things like, I've been getting a lot of criticism, I know that all you guys, you know, understand that I'm a good guy and what I'm doing is, you know, important for the world and I'm trying to help it, but it's really hard, you know, to keep constantly being attacked by the mainstream, by all these people casting my character badly. And like, maybe if I can't get the community, you know, to kind of fight back for me, or, you know, to get rid of these bad members, I'll need to, you know, withdraw and stop producing content, and because it's just too much for me. Like I want to do it, but I can't really be putting up with it. So in that way, then they'll also say, well, I didn't tell anyone to go like harass the people that I've targeted or whatever. But you did very strongly imply that that's what you want people to do. And they will often, in the Web 2.0 era, it's normal in a way to have some degree of parasocial interactions with people that are producing content. I think it's just the nature of us as social primates that that's going to happen. But there are people that use that power and like that more lean into the manipulative aspect of it, where there is a one-way devotion. And they, essentially with the gurus, they tend to be leaning into it in a very unhealthy way and constantly flattering their audience at the same time as sometimes like what's the word?
Love bombing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, essentially what you do with kids.
You awakening wonders, as Russell Brand says.
Yeah, but also that aspect of like when somebody steps out of line, you have to be willing to reprimand them and kind of teach your group what is okay behavior and what is not. Like we just covered Hassan Piker, a leftist streamer, and on his streams, he absolutely tears into people that he regards as making a point that he doesn't like or criticizing them in a way. And he'll yell at them and kind of disparage them to the group, make fun of them. And if you are somebody, you know, that is in his audience.
Public shaming, yeah, and public humiliation.
Exactly. And, you know, the person, maybe that person leaves the group, but the other people in the group are getting the sign, all right, well, there's, I don't want that to happen to me. Right. So I better at least word my criticism very carefully. So, yeah.
So good old fashioned scapegoating mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. Scapegoating. And also the other aspect of it that I think is worth mentioning is that if you are creating those dynamics, you essentially give yourself a ready-made explanation for when you receive criticism, especially if it comes from like mainstream sources, the media, academics, scientists. You can present it that your critics, the fact that you have critics and the fact that people are attacking your character or your conspiratorial tendencies, that is a demonstration that you are correct. And very often they will cast it that you will see, I will be attacked for this, right? And then they will take some insane position or put forward all conspiracies. And then they are criticized for it. And they say, see, I told you. And it's kind of like, it's depressing that that works, but it works very well.
So so that feeds into my next theme, or one of the next conditions of being a secular guru. And this is really a kind of more, I guess, more sociological point, which is, well, it's anti-establishment Arianism, as you guys call it, which seems to me to be the mood music of the world at the moment. It's like a continual critique of the day, When you ask who the day is, as I have done in conversation with folk, they're not very specific. It's just this, and this like transcends political boundary. Yeah. This transcends knowledge and medicine. And you see it in the anti-vax stuff as well. You see it in like critiques of, I don't know, Big Pharma. You see it in critiques of the war in Ukraine and the Iraq, that in some way there is a set of institutions and those institutions are bad.
There's a quote from Douglas Murray when he was talking, and Douglas Murray, you know, a little bit more of a partisan right-wing pundit, but nonetheless, I think he does slip into the secular guru role quite often. And actually, Eric Weinstein named the intellectual dark web after him, so he claims anyway. But he said on institutions, nobody in an institution now can tell the truth.
Right.
And it's slightly worse than that. That people in an institution are lying about everything almost all the time. that's what he said, right? So that's what we mean by anti-establishmentarianism, because sometimes we're mistaken on this to be saying, like, don't critique mainstream institutions and establishment. And like, obviously that's fine. There's plenty of things to critique in all mainstream institutions, establishments, even ones that are good, you know, like even ones that you might like, the NHS and all. There's plenty of things to criticize, but anti-establishmentarianism is more like everything in the mainstream is corrupt. Everybody is lying, and it works to set up the guru as an alternative, reliable, honest epistemic source. All of those alternative epistemic sources are exploitative and bad and evil. I'm good. And again, very obviously self-serving, but it's a very appealing narrative, and you can see it in politics just as you can see it with secular guru types. So yeah, I agree with you that it's really, really common. And you even have, you know, the richest man in the world now posing as an anti-establishment like figure. So it doesn't even matter. Yeah, if you're a billionaire and, you know, you're living in mansions, you can still be an anti-establishment person now, which is, it's just a very weird quirk of the modern era.
One of the things that strikes me about it is, and I think this is peculiar, it'd be interesting to see what you think, is that it's what anti-establishment discourse, so it's like, you know, the mainstream media, so the government, the police, whatever, academics and institutions. Yeah, so that the idea that the institution is inherently bad, but it, quite often it seems to be quite patriotic. It seems it's in one country, like, so it's anti-establishmentarianism in one country, basically. However, if we're talking about Iraq, or we're talking about Russia, or anywhere there's a tyranny, those establishments are brilliant.
No, it's definitely true. It's a very selective. Like, I did make this point with Sam Harris recently when I was talking to him, like, that for all the people that are now expressing great concerns about the level of anti-Semitism that is, you know, has appeared after the conflict in Gaza, a lot of those people that are, you know, talking about that are very, very friendly with Hungary and Orban's government. And, like, that government was perfectly, and still is perfectly fine, you know, with using anti-Semitic tropes to further its anti-democratic mission. So you would imagine if you're really about principled defense of democracies and liberal democracies, and you want to clamp down on anti-Semitism, Hungary would be a country of concern, but they didn't have and still don't have much concern about that. So, you know, it seems incongruous to me, but it's not that incongruous when you realize that they don't have any care about being consistent or things making sense like that. And the other thing which they do is that they have to do this, like, funny little dance where they at once want to discredit the institutions, but because they're secular gurus in the most part, they often rely on the credentials provided from institutions or, you know, those sources. So they'll at once be kind of promoting the fact that they are a trained psychologist or they got an education at Harvard, while saying, but, you know, when I was doing it, it was kind of, there were bits that were good or there were real figures that were still able to, like, haunt around, but now it's full of all lickspittles and CRT devotees. And they also very often want to set up alternative so-called institutions, but in most cases it's just like basically like profit making, because Jordan Peterson is about to release, like, Peterson University.
Oh, Barry Weiss's university, for example.
Barry Weiss has the University of Texas in Austin, or I don't know what it is. It's very close to an existing university name there. And there was the recent ARC, the Alliance of Responsible Citizens, which I don't think it was a success as they hoped, but they intended it to be a conservative reaction to the WEF. I don't think it quite worked to that level, but that's how they cast it. So there's the constant thing about the institutions are corrupt, they give me my qualifications, so that's, you know, they did one thing right, but actually I'm going to recreate the institutions with my friends, and if you subscribe for as absurd amount of money, you know, you can get something which nobody will recognize as a qualification. Yeah, it seems cynical, but I actually think a lot of them are genuine in their, what I would describe as, delusion about, you know, the value that these things will provide. But some of them are just cynical, like Jordan Peterson had branded, like, business school courses that he was very little to do with, that were essentially scams. Yeah, before his now thing where he said, not Peterson Academy.
Okay, so another theme that I, seeing as I have you, what I wanted to ask you, Chris, was on the question of psychopathy and sociopathy. Mm. Right now, it's not one of the things that you mention a lot, but when I think of, like, your classic gurus, your, I don't know, your Jim Jones, your Charles Mansons, your David Koresh's, I don't think it would be much of a leap to suggest that they are on the psychopathic or sociopathic spectrum. So, is this something? Is that something you and your colleague Is it Matthew Brown, isn't it? Yeah, that talk about that much. But I was wondering, do you have any thoughts about that? Are they demonstrating these tendencies, or is it something that maybe is even absent in secular gurus?
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't given it that much thought. I think that there are some people that we've covered that I wouldn't be that hesitant about describing them as having sociopathic tendencies. Scott Adams, the cartoonist who wrote Dilbert, would be a good example of that. But it's just but I think in general, I would say that the more core aspect that I notice is not a sociopathy or a psychopathy, like a lack of ability to feel empathy or a kind of complete disregard for others except through instrumental needs. It's more narcissism, I think, is really...
That was my next question.
Yeah, so you have the dark triad, right, in psychology of, what is it, narcissism and psychopathy, and I forgot the other wheel of it, but so they are related, but I think in those cases, in the guru's cases, a lot more of it falls into the kind of bag of narcissistic personality types. And you know, whether it reaches this level of being a diagnosable pathology, that's not what I'm claiming, because they're all pretty functional in the world, right? Like, they're all successful people, and a lot of definitions of pathology revolve around, like, you know, how much it's impairing your daily life, and many of them are very successful and popular people. But I definitely think that their personality is largely defined by their egos and need to feed it, and their belief that they're special, and the belief that they haven't been given enough recognition. And one thing which is like really striking is, as I just said, some of them are hugely successful. Like, you know, the most successful people in certain fields, right, in terms of getting attention, but they're very insecure about not getting enough attention. So Jordan Peterson was just on Twitter, I think today or yesterday, complaining that some interview he did recently didn't get as many views as he, you know, anticipated. So he immediately leapt to, you know, it's because of the algorithm, there's some reason they don't want it to get out. Brett Weinstein had the exact same thing. That was one of the reasons he was complaining to Elon Musk, was, you know, that he wasn't trending enough when he released things. And they're constantly, it does strike you as like sort of pathetic, because they have so much attention, but they seem to be so needy for more and for validation. But I mean, you look at someone like Elon Musk, and it's really clear that he just wants attention and to feel like, you know, acknowledged by various people and so on. So I don't think those personality defects are necessarily prevent you from being successful.
That makes sense to me. I think it was Freud said it. I think he said his idea was that, I mean, whatever you think about Freud, I can't imagine a lot, Chris, actually.
But, well, I think in terms of like illustrating points, he's very useful.
and here I go. So he said narcissism is premised on weakness of a sort, isn't it? So, and isn't that one of the traits that you talk about, that these secular gurus they have a very thin skin when it comes to criticism. They're very fragile, very precarious in some way.
Yeah, there's like in psychology, there's a distinction between like grandiose narcissists and insecure narcissists, or it's really their trait. So, you know, you might have both, or you might have one or the other, but they result in different things. But like you said, the feeling that you are like, I think Trump in certain respects illustrates, you know, grandiose narcissism, right? The complete utter confidence that you are a hugely special person and all these kind of things. But insecure narcissism is the flip side, or vulnerable narcissism, that you you feel that you're being undervalued, right? Because you have such a high opinion of your of yourself. And that is the a feature that we see, that basically in almost all of the occasions, especially with like the people that score higher on the scale, they have these narratives that their whole life they've been, even if they've been wildly successful, that they've been constantly pushed down, constantly overlooked, constantly not given enough credit for what they've achieved. And it also feeds into the conspiratorial reasoning, because it's it presents it as, you know, that there are nefarious forces that were trying to stop them for whatever reason, right? And it's, yeah, it is interesting, because in a lot of the cases, objectively, they're very successful and popular people. So you would think that that should fulfill the egoic needs, but it seems to be a black hole in some cases. And yeah, I don't know why people would look up. One of the things that surprises me a little bit is I understand why people like Jordan Peterson's output. I think there is valuable stuff that you can get from 12 Rules for Life as a stern follower figure, you know, talking about psychology, you could do worse, but he's also an unhinged reactionary maniac. But if you just look at his, you know, Twitter behavior, he's not somebody with any impulse control. He says stupid things every day. And I kind of feel like a lot of people either completely ignore that, or they just compartmentalize it and say, you know, but the thing is, it's the same guy, right? It's the same guy. This I don't buy this distinction that a lot of people make about the online and the offline, you know, personas being completely distinct things. Because yes, there are people that are braver online and all that kind of thing. But I think if you watch someone online for a couple of years, you know them actually quite well. You know, like it's hard to disguise what your personality is like over that amount of time.
That's the origin of the parasocial relation as well, isn't it? Like the idea that you can have a bond with these people as well, yeah.
Yeah, and that is also something I think that is very relevant and interesting, because like I experienced this long before I had a podcast myself. I listened to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Maybe you know it, right? A kind of old skeptical podcast, still going. But there was a guy on that called Perry D'Angelo. He was a heavyset American guy back in the day. And he was, you know, quite a character, you would say, right? He was a little bit more conservative than the rest of them, but he was also just like an opinionated guy and that kind of thing. And he died. He did some episodes where he was calling in from the hospital and was like slightly delirious, but in the end, he died. I don't know, you know, the details.
I don't.
But I remember when that happened, it hit me like, you know, somebody I had known.
Like a pal died, yeah.
Yeah, and it was the first time for that. You know, I've had celebrities or people that I liked had died, but it never felt like there was a relationship directly. And I realized when I had that, I found it like kind of interesting and understandable, but it was also like, I think long form podcasts and the intimacy of like listening to people talk for hours, It just primate brains are set up to take that as, you know, social interaction. And so I think people do genuinely build emotional attachments.
Chris, there's power in the disembodied voice. There's power in the disembodied voice. It's what the Wizard of Oz was about.
There's egregores everywhere. But the thing about it is that I think on the other flip side of that, like there's lots of sinister implications for that. But there's also the fact that, like, just to give a counterexample, I listened to a podcast called Very Bad Wizards by a psychologist and a philosopher, where they're talking about, you know, various topics, often more intellectual than I can follow. But, you know, I listened to them for a couple of years and I felt like I knew them and their character because of the whole parasocial thing. And then we invited one of the hosts on the podcast. And as soon as and he was listening to our show as well. And when I talked to him, it was exactly, you know, the way that I imagined him to be, because I'd spent hours listening to him and, it, you know, vice versa. So it's a weird thing where I don't think it's always artificial, that, you know, you're not, I think that you actually are often getting an idea of what the person's like. Now, it's not Andrew Tate and all that kind of thing. I think this is different, but I think it's quite hard for people who are putting out hours and hours of content to not reveal what their personalities and stuff are actually like. So yeah, I think that is like sort of neutral, but we can't escape that we're in like the parasocial era now, and it's going to get worse as technology gets better.
Oh, you throw AI into the mix, and yeah, who knows, you could be having a parasocial relation with a simulacrum of Joe Rogan or something like that. Speaking of Joe, one of the things I wanted to ask you, I had to ask you, is like, what's with the supplements? It seems to be a constant. I mean, on some level, I think it's like the kind of the snake oil salesman stuff to trying to make a profit out of this, that you have some kind of secret health knowledge. But like, you have folk who won't take a vaccine, that put any old crap into their bodies. What do you think that's indicative of?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that I think that relates to, and like one of them is exactly what you said, that, you know, there's this video which you can find from like about 10 or 15 years ago where Joe Rogan is going through his cupboard about the supplements.
I've seen it.
It's just like there's 20, right? He's just taking out, and he's the guy.
It's a lot.
That is at the same time constantly disparaging, you know, people from putting in, you know, like chemicals or mainstream medicine, vaccines, the dangers, and it's like you're pumping yourself with a much less well regulated concoction of chemicals. But in any case, I think that one thing that Matt has mentioned quite a bit is that, like the anti-vaccine crossover that you mentioned, there seems to be genuine investment in concerns about like death and mortality and the life and the function of the body, right? Like existential fears, right? And so the notion that something would be, first of all, and this relates to conspirituality, that there would be a non-bespoke treatment which applies to everyone, and it doesn't matter about your personality or your ethnicity, right? It's just a vaccine. It works for everyone. That doesn't fit with the notion that you're special, because you should have, you know, you're healthier than other people. You're not like all the other people. So there's that. There's the notion about like kind of being afraid about other foreign substances going into your body, but as we've seen, you know, there's an inconsistency around that concern, but that doesn't really matter. But I think the other thing which it leans into is pharmaceutical industry is easily presented as, you know, evil with lots of good reasons to criticize it, but it's an institution that can't be trusted. However, supplements, alternative medicines, and so on, you know, they're very good at marketing themselves as a response to the abuses of the pharmaceutical industry. So it kind of fits in that if you're presenting yourself as like an iconoclast who, you know, doubts the mainstream, that you're not going to be promoting a mainstream medicine. You need to have like a bespoke special medicine, which is for, you know, people who really get it. So I think all those things go together. And then there's the pure economics, that it's an absolute you know, way to print cash for yourself. And like Joe Rogan, that, you know, I keep bringing up this point about like hypocrisy and inconsistency, but Joe Rogan was in a senior position with Onnit, right? A supplement, you know, alternative treatment, I don't know what way to put it, but like basically a supplement company, which he promoted on this show, which, you know, has Alpha Brain, various other products, with very dubious claims or evidence bases. Not dubious, the claims are dubious because the evidence base isn't there. But he sold that, he and his partners sold it to Unilever for a multi-million pound deal.
No, I wasn't aware of this.
Right, so he took money from a transnational, international company, got a huge payout, right? And you would imagine that should cause some, you know, dissonance, because he's already a multimillionaire just from, you know, the podcast and the UFC and all that kind of thing. But for some reason, that's not presented as being a selling out of to the mainstream or whatever. But the supplement industry and the alternative medicine industry, it's huge.
Massive.
It's not like little small people on the corner.
Yeah, it's like sort of mom and pop entrepreneurs.
It's huge companies making massive profits, but that is okay.
Yeah, so it always struck me about Joe Rogan was that he's someone who's has a fear of his own finitude. I think that's interesting. You should say you put pause into something like that. I always kind of looked at his, you know, his kind of COVID skepticism or his anti-vax stuff as a kind of a form of anxiety. I was like, I'm looking at the guy and I'm like going, you know, is anybody not seeing this? The guy's got a serious case of health anxiety, but you know, the world's sort of most prominent case of a white coat fever, effectively, you know. And he's like a health fanatic. He's into strength and life elongation and transhumanism and all these folk on him.
Yeah, he was taking human growth hormone, TRT, right, which are. At least TRT can be a legitimate treatment, right? Like if you are have low testosterone, but a lot of people are supplementing, you know, needlessly, or at least in a way that could be potentially harmful, right? So that would be a much, human growth hormone is going to have a much bigger physiological impact than the COVID vaccine, right? But in Joe's case, at the beginning of the pandemic, for example, he was talking about how he was waking up in bed at night sweating because he was afraid of getting the, you know, COVID, right? He was terrified of it, really terrified. And then he flipped.
Yeah, I sympathize with him. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, everybody at the start was, but, you know, but there were degrees. And he was really, like Alex Jones and stuff in his audience were actually doing a similar sort of thing, but you know, it's now forgotten because they've moved on to, you know, basically downplaying it because conservative politics. But Joe Rogan's fear, like you said, it kind of then, you know, maybe like going through the stages of grief, it seems to have transposed into denial. And he is, out of all the people, the one that is constantly talking about COVID, constantly talking about how scared everyone else is, about how weak everyone else is, you know, all these fat people, that's why they're dying. And it really does feel like a compensation mechanism because
the lady don't protest too much, I guess.
Yeah, he was afraid and he is afraid of vaccination, right? And like, I think that's a, you know, a fear that a lot of people have. It's a, you know, maybe it's a evolutionarily coherent fear about
it's common, yeah,
having external things come into your body and all this kind of thing. But he presents it as a flaw of everyone else. You know, they don't get what he does, and you kind of feel like,
right,
you know, maybe the issue is a little bit closer to home. Like most people are not talking about COVID now, right? Like the people that are presented as the sheeple, the scared, terrified people, apart from Taylor Lorenz showing up, you know, without or masks to an interview or whatever, the majority of people got on with their lives after the vaccine, and they get a booster if they're told to do it, you know, because it'll have gone through the trials and that. But, you know, vaccines aren't this thing that most people orientate their entire professional output and commentary around. But Joe can barely go a week without bringing it up multiple times. So, yeah, it's and then you just have the fact as well that the anti-vaccine movement was supercharged during COVID, and it has a whole bunch of those characteristics that kind of parallel the things that the gurus like. And so RFK Jr., he is a anti-vaxxer first and foremost, but he's also a conspiracy theorist. He's also like a narcissistic person and all these things. So I think there is, like we said at the start, you know, a bunch of parallel areas where you get crossover, and you get figures like Brett Weinstein, who went from being a secular guru to being a secular guru who is primarily an anti-vaxxer. Like that is a path that you can take.
I think I was reading, I don't know, I'd be interested if you guys did him actually, Peter Turchin. He did the sort of kind of cleodynamics guy.
Oh.
He did, he wrote a book called End Times, yeah. But...
yeah, I'm on some papers or research groups. I can't remember which, but with Peter. So if we cover him, it could be potentially awkward. But I do want to cover him nonetheless.
Yeah, because his idea struck me that the idea of the counter elite, because in some way that's what's happening with that. It's not that they're anti-institution, but they're setting up kinds of counter institutions. So like Rogan and his alternative health business or whatever.
There's you've exactly, I think, P- Peter's theories, the Cleo dynamic stuff, I think there are some potential issues about cherry picking of that at this important point. But his basic point about elite overproduction, I think, is very well argued, right, and established. That and you know, this is a really an illustration of the immunity to cringe factor, because Eric Weinstein, Brett's brother, who ran a hedge fund for Peter Thiel, and I think was more of a figurehead than actually running and that, but in any case, in some interview he was talking to someone and he said, you know, you might, because they were saying, you know, you just hate institutions and you're just reactionary. And he said, do you see me sitting in a jacket here? Do you think I like wearing jackets? And, you know, it was an odd thing. And then he said, I'm wearing a jacket so I can show the people that I'm ready to step up if they, you know, invite me to head the thing, invite me to the WEF, to the, you know, whatever it is.
Peter Thiel's offshore libertarian utopia.
Yeah, but no, not that. But more like, if the mainstream authorities recognize him and put him in control of, you know, the CDC or whatever, he's already got the jacket, so he's ready to go. Just
well, then.
What the hell? Maybe you should wear a t-shirt.
He's got a tie, Chris. He's got a tie.
Yeah, because, well, the other thing, although it's not necessarily true in the kind of things he wants to get into, but, you know, the people that are actually the ones that you know, come from outside the system and get in, they tend to be the ones wearing shirts and no shoes, or, you know, a t-shirt, as opposed to the people trying to look the part to get by the gatekeeper. So Eric's just, but that struck me as what a strange thing to admit to people, that you're dressing in a suit to illustrate that you are someone to take seriously, and you're ready to be called up, you know, to the big times if you need to be. And just maybe you shouldn't say that.
In terms of practical techniques, I'm trying to think, outside of the research that you and your colleague are going to do via the Decoding the Gurus, I'm trying to think, what do you think what you're doing matters? I mean, that's kind of the philosophical question. What's the significance of this? I can see one really important element in this, and that's just kind of rhetorical literacy about the techniques that secular gurus use to maybe bamboozle you or make you part from your hard-earned cash or whatever. But I'm trying to think, could you maybe expand on that? What are some of the practical strategies, or what are the practical strategies or interventions or things people can be thinking about, or heuristics can counteract credulism and conspiracism and radicalization as well, I suppose, at the more extreme end?
Yeah. So, I can say two things, because the first part that you asked about was, you know, what are goal and motivation in what are we doing, right? From the kind of bigger picture thing. And I think that it's quite a basic answer, and it's probably not satisfying to philosophers, but I think Matt and I are content to just be a source out there in discourse land that is arguing for the importance of critical thinking, looking at, you know, pausing when you're following along with things, and taking a bit of an academic, maybe slightly empirically minded, but more just a critical academic approach to the claims that are being made and what people are doing, and like you said, trying to notice the rhetoric and emotional manipulation and all that kind of thing. So our contribution is, you know, we're not planning to change the world, and we don't really see ourselves as activist types, right? We're more we are approaching it a bit more in the detached academic out of fashion way of, this is an interesting phenomenon. Of course, we don't like it, right? We don't like the most toxic elements of it, but we're not under any illusion that we're going to be able to stop it. But I do think, on the other hand, that alongside analyzing it in the way that we do and trying to point out techniques that people are using and that, we also have a lot of fun in looking at the people, because they are ridiculous in many respects, and, you know, they take themselves so incredibly seriously that having someone stop and like say, what the hell are they talking about, right? Or like following through the logic of their insane mind palace metaphor that they've constructed, I think that actually does help in when people are confronted with somebody like criticizing a person that they've invested a lot in. They can react negatively and they've been primed to present that as like a bad faith person. But whenever somebody is like, you know, they're not presenting the person as the worst thing that has happened to the world, and they're just like pointing out, but isn't this stupid? Like, isn't this like, let's see what he's actually saying here, or she is actually saying here. And we have got a lot of feedback that, you know, people who were followers of various figures that we've covered, that they didn't pay attention to a lot of the critiques before because they basically regarded them as bad faith, right? And there are plenty of people that think we are bad faith as well, but a lot of people had said, it's because you didn't seem to be coming in with a political agenda and you didn't, you know, present it that they're at heart an evil person, like, with a couple of exceptions, like that it actually made them more open to listening. And also, like, Matt and I don't mind saying whenever somebody makes a good point or you know, that kind of thing, like, you know, Alex Jones, it's very rare, but he can make a good point on occasion. And I think it's a disservice if you're not willing to do that. So in terms of the, I'm sorry that was so long-winded, by the way, after I was complaining about long-winded stuff, but in terms of like the practical techniques, the one thing I would say is like, consume whatever content you like, but do it critically. Like that is one thing. And then the second thing is, what we do in the podcast is quite rare, right? To like pause after, you know, take what somebody is saying, pause it and comment on it, right? Like that's not the normal way people consume content, but I think it is the way that you should sometimes, especially if somebody is making like a really big claim, or, you know, they're saying something about all institutions lie and whatever, you should be then like, okay, so that's a big claim. So what's their evidence going to be? And, you know, when I was talking to Sam Harris, for example, he said, you know, in the US, every student is now being taught about like critical race theory and anti-white thing. And I said, he said they all have to learn about, you know, candy at a kindergarten or something like that. And I said, it's not true in all schools in America. And he, in one sentence, changed to say, well, at least in all, you know, private schools in Manhattan. And you're like, right, but that's quite a different, this is a hell of a step down from, yeah, that like one is a indoctrination system that, yeah, the other is a problem for the rich elites at their like highly selective, you know, like highly expensive schools. So, yeah.
So he means his school, where his kids go to school, basically.
That was the sense that I got.
Okay, so I'm gonna just try and, just to round it all off, I'm gonna play a little game with you, Chris. Okay. I'm gonna name six or seven people, and I want your yes, no, secular guru or not. Okay. Uh-huh. I mean, obviously you can say no. I want your instinct, basically, in a game of, you know, gun to the head, yes or no. And I wrote off the first one because I was going to say King Charles III. Is he a secular guru? But he's not really secular. He's the head of the Church of England.
I also know very little about him. Oh wait, that's King Charles, that's the present king, right? I was just like, is that a historical? Yeah. But that's the present king. And the answer for him is yes, by the way. But so I can give you that.
He likes his alternative medicine.
Exactly.
Michel Foucault.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
Gabor Maté.
Yes. 100%. Yes.
Aaron Maté.
No.
Sam Bankman-Fried.
No. No, but with an asterisk.
Okay. So I'm not sure if you probably have heard of this chap. Blind by Boat Club. Irish podcaster and influencer, for those who don't know.
Blind Boy Boat Club. I was thinking of the Rubber Bandits.
That is the Rubber Bandits, yeah.
Yeah, that's but the Blind Boy Boat. Oh, it is the Rubber Bandits, right? Yeah, it's one of them, isn't that? Or is it both of them?
Yes, it's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, I don't know. I actually haven't looked into that stuff, but I would have initially said no, that's a comedy band, but from what I heard about the podcast, I think I would probably lean towards yes, but I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion. But I think he's definitely in that arena.
It'd be interesting. He's in that influencer. I think the thing that might make him score less on your barometer is that he's quite self-reflective and can be self-critical quite often. But there you go. Okay, here's one for you. I know you lived in London for a bit. I think you lived in London, did you, Chris?
I did, yeah, for a long time.
Jeremy Corbyn.
No.
I would agree. Maybe some of his followers, perhaps, but definitely Jeremy Corbyn. Last one, Taylor Swift.
No, also no. Yeah.
Okay. You're a Swiftie.
Yeah, you. That's a good game. It's a very frustrating game because the desire is to, you know, clarify. But I think the interesting thing with a lot of the people that you picked out is there are going. You know, I would need to look at their content, that kind of thing. But I think there are ways in which they are falling close to that template and ways in which they are not. And but like in the case of, like, say, Jeremy Corbyn, like you said, I think there was a personality cult that developed around him. But I think in terms of he himself, he's essentially, you know, a leftist politician leader. He hasn't really changed that much since the 70s, right? So he feels relatively consistent and better understood as a kind of left-wing politician than as a modern secular guru. But he might have been cast in that role by some people.
Last question. Of all of them, which one do you hate the most?
Oh,
it's Lex Fridman, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's not him. Although he's definitely one of the most annoying.
It's not? Okay.
Yeah.
Not our favorite techno monk.
Yeah. He is like up there in terms of his ability to just be so cloying and annoying online. But I don't think, like, my hate tends to be reserved for the people that I think are doing very sinister things. So, like, even though Eric Weinstein scores very highly, and I do think he has a negative impact overall, I also think he's, in the grand scheme of things, fairly inconsequential. So I can't muster that much strong resentment towards him. We just recently covered Hassan Piker, so he's like fresh in my mind, and that was a very unpleasant thing to cover. So, but I wouldn't put him there. I think probably, I really don't like the polemical right wing people presenting themselves as not that and encouraging like polemicism. And, you know, like it's one thing to be like a right-wing reactionary. It's another to do that and to cast it as that is not what is happening. So even though he doesn't score particularly high in the grammar when we covered him, I would say, like, I really don't like people like Scott Adams and Constantine Kissin and that kind of thing, because maybe part of the thing is that I would self-categorize myself as like a moderate left-wing person who is, you know, has critiques of the left, right? That famous, not the classical liberal stereotype, but like literally just a moderate left person. But I'm, as a result, I find all the classical liberal that are obviously right-wing apologists, that's the most annoying thing for me, because they're kind of like casting me into the, you know, the anytime I identify in that same category, the people's eyebrows raise. So yeah, that's a biased reason, but that whole package, I don't like that, the polemicist who won't acknowledge. So Douglas Murray, you know, I really don't like his stuff, but he is a known polemicist in a way, right? Like a right wing, he's a right wing journalist. So, you know, that's what it is, what it is.
He's explicit about it in some regards to him. He is quite upfront about what he thinks. But the others are more disingenuous, yeah.
Yeah, in a way that some of them aren't. And like, yeah, and I think that the Sensemaker people, for example, they typify a whole lot of the secular guru things, and they can have reactionary politics and that, but they're also mostly they're busy. They're essentially like, you know, a pseudo theologian having conversations with other pseudo theologians and philosophers. So it's not that harmful. It's just probably mostly middle-aged men enjoying their time. So I can't muster that much anger at them either.
And what's wrong with that, Chris? Nothing wrong with that, Chris. And here we are. So
there's nothing wrong. I middle-aged men on podcasts, that's what we that's what we are meant to do. So that's fine. You just maybe, you know, when the reactionary politics,
who else will listen to us?
Yeah, a sideshow. That's when I'm okay with it. But when it's your main thing, not good. And actually, you know, now that you said it, I would also say Brett Weinstein, not Eric Weinstein, but Brett Weinstein, I think is, and Joe Rogan, because of the anti-vaccine stuff, they are really like cancerous on the public discourse because of the amount, you know, disinformation and also just like reactionary conspiratorial takes that they pump out. Many of the people that were prominent in the pandemic as anti-vax figures would have remained in the anti-vax ecosystem, except they appeared on Joe Rogan, and the person who brought them to Joe Rogan was Brett Weinstein. So those two.
All right. I think that's, so I just want to say thanks so much, Chris, for being on with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.